coming up on this episode of Embracing Change with Lakrita Bowman and Jennifer Osborne.
And so all of that just like was more compound stuff to make this little 5-year-old girl still believe at 17, can't trust nobody, cannot bear your heart to nobody, cannot be vulnerable, cannot. And not that any of those things were my fault, but they were my reality.
So let's jump into chapter 2, which was titled Being Dropped or Dropped Off. And the byline to that said, the little girl that was born in 1960 and abandoned by her birth mother was controlling your every move. So explain a little bit about that little girl and how she was controlling your every move and what the origins of your story of being dropped off and how you discovered who you were or who you were not as you could look at that way. Just talk a little bit about that.
Well, I think that being dropped or being dropped off is they're kind of like a dichotomy kind of word. You know, it's like when I was 5, I kind of realized that I wasn't who I thought I was. I was living with a mother. Her name was Mary Helen and Wilms, and my name was different than hers. My last name was Turner. Her last name was Wilms. And we were in the kindergarten, getting ready to go to first grade. And back then, you did cursive writing. You learn how, you know, that was an exercise that you learn how to cursive write. Of course, today, that's not so much. And so I was writing, we were all writing our parents' name and our names and on the big line paper. And, you know, I noticed that the young girl next to me had the same name, or her mother, her father, herself had the same last name. And I noticed that my name was different than my mom's. And so I asked the teacher, like, why is my name different than my mom's? And she said, oh, that's not a conversation I need to have with you. That's something you need to go and have, ask your mom. I'm not sure what that is. It can be many reasons, but you need to ask your mom. So, of course, inquisitive. And I think now when I look back at my life, another aha moment I'm having right now, I'm just talking about it, because I'm now almost 60, I'm such a concrete thinker. Black and white, absolute, pretty much no. And I think from that 5-year-old little girl that got broken from being inquisitive and curious, was not given, like, that little girl was not encouraged to be that way. And so when I got home, that little girl asked her mom, like, Mom, why is my name different? And my mother, which is my foster mom, said, why does it matter? You know, why, you know, leave it alone. It don't matter. You know, you are my daughter. It don't matter why your name is different than mine. And I'm like, well, everybody at school's name, and it probably wasn't the same everybody, but for me in that moment, everybody, because the little girl next to me, or her parents' name was the same. And I want to know why my name is not like yours. And she's like, oh, it just don't matter. It just don't matter. And, you know, as time went on, I did not let it go. I pursued it because that's the kind of person I am. You know, I'm relentless. And I continue to pursue it until one day, out of frustration, I believe, and anger, and just being the kind of person she was, she just said, you know, you keep on asking me the same old thing. Well, if you just got to know, it's not because I'm your real mother. And I was like, what does that mean? You're not my real mother. And she said, I didn't give birth to you. You know, your mother and I was friends, and she dropped you off and for me to babysit one day, and she never did come back and get you. And I said, what does that mean? And the best she could, she explained it as, you know, your mom and I worked at a dry cleaners. Her name was Evelyn. We were good friends. She asked me to babysit you, and you were with me, and you have not left me since. And I was like, well, how old was I? And she said, oh, you probably was about 18 months old. And I said, I'm 5. So, like, where is she? And she was like, I don't know. And she tried to explain to me that before we were in Hamilton by this time, and I was trying to explain that we came from Louisville, Kentucky, and by this time that she had went to talk to Evelyn, and Evelyn couldn't be found, and she left her information with Evelyn's mom, that she was leaving for Ohio, and if Evelyn wanted to come and get me or make arrangements, that she could call her and that she would make sure that she got me back. And she said, so far she has not came back and got you. So that's how it is. And in that moment, it's just like, how do you make sense of all that? How do you bring that into a conclusion of, like, somebody just left me. She just dropped me and dropped me off. She did both and never came back and got me. And I'm 5 years old. And this woman is trying to explain it the best she can. And I can't really hear her. I can just hear, wah, 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 wah. Even at five, I couldn't even hear her because I couldn't process it. So I believe in that moment, the trajectory of my life and identity changed because who I thought I was not. And I was not who I thought I was, if that makes sense. So I had to begin to believe and perceive and try to make sense of it. And I did my best with what I had at a five-year-old little girl.
What did that do to your feeling of belonging? So you have a foster mom who is, on one hand, said, I want you, I'm raising you. But then you hear your birth mother did not. Like, how did that affect
you? And I'm not even sure that I connected her not wanting me. All I knew is that she wasn't there. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. And that if she had the option to come get me in 3 years, she had not. And so I had a foster mother saying that I want you. But for me, I couldn't hear her. The lack of wanting was louder than the wanting. The lack of the abandonment was louder than the belonging. The rejection was louder than the acceptance. The lost identity was louder than I have an identity in this woman. So all of those opposites were louder, negatives was louder than the reality. The lies was louder. And so I think I leaned towards the lies. And throughout that, that little girl became the controlling factor of my life. Everything that happened to me and every decision I made from abandonment, rejection, loss of identity, not being loved, not being wanted. I need to protect myself from everybody because everybody's no good and nobody's truthful. So that inquisitive little girl that came home a month or two before got broken. And so now this concrete little girl, this absolute little girl, this is how it's going to be, little girl. She was formed. And so she would judge the world from that place and people from that place. They couldn't be trusted. It wasn't trustworthy. I'm going to get you before you get me. And of course, we went through life, you know, in that moment. You know, I went through my foster mother's, boyfriend abusing me. And again, I feel like my foster mother could have defended me and protected me. But she chose him over me because, again, children were seen and not heard. Children don't talk. They don't. Grown-ups were the truth tellers, and children were the children. And so when Mr. Sam would sexually abuse me when my mom would go to work and I finally had the courage to tell on him, he had already told me that she wouldn't believe me. And he was right. And so he set me up and put money in my drawer, my dresser drawer, and told my mom when I get ready to tell her at the dinner table, I'll never forget it. And he said that, you know, she's a thief. You know, I've been missing money out of my wallet. It's probably in her room somewhere. You need to probably go look and see. But I think I just didn't want to tell you because I ain't want you to beat her. And he knew he was lying. And so, you know, again, my foster mother, again, I felt like in that moment, this little girl that I really felt like was running, you know, ruling my life. She was only at this point, she's 7 or 8 now, and she's saying, see, I told you, nobody is going to be able to take care of you like we can. I'm the only person you can trust. Nobody else is trustworthy. We've got to take care of ourselves. We got to armor ourselves up. We've got to put on this image that nobody's going to, you know, hurt us. Nobody's going to, you know, do anything. So she started running away. She started, you know what I'm saying, becoming really rebellious. You know, she was very competitive in school. She would sell candy. You know, she would always, you know what I'm saying, win. And it was only, you know, because these things were in me, being an entrepreneur, a leader. You know, I was always the highest in selling candy. When I was in the Flip Twisters, I was multi. I was able to jump rope, bamboo hop, do flips. You know, I was able to do them all. So it was like I was always, whatever it did, whenever I did anything, I can't say always and never, but whenever I did anything, I took it serious and I gave it all I had. I didn't half step in it. It didn't matter whether it was right or wrong, good or bad. I gave it all I got. And so that little girl from that day on, and those horrific situations that was happening to her, you know, because this man, you know, and took advantage of her for 3 years. And, you know, he was a drunk. And I'm just sure that in my own forgiveness, I've learned that hurt people hurt people. I've also learned through that moment that someone must have hurt him or made him believe that that was an appropriate behavior for him to implement that same behavior on me. And so, yeah, so that, you know, that kind of like started, that moment kind of began to start the whole promises, prophecies that I would make to myself. Nobody's ever going to hurt me. Nobody's ever going to get close enough to hurt me. And so that little girl was saying, I'm going to always take care of you. I'm always, you know, but she's 5, right? I'm growing up chronologically, but not emotionally, not developmentally. I'm still that 5-year-old little girl fighting the world, trying to protect and make sense of something that was lost, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. And you talk about the self-fulfilling prophecies of people can't be trusted, mm-hmm. and therefore I have to trust myself.
Exactly.
People will abandon, so...
People will hurt, they will lie on you. So it's, you know, this thing I used to say, there's no honor among thieves, right? You know, that was my motto. You know, if I'll steal from you and you'll steal from me, I mean, if we steal together, you know, my mother used to always say, a liar and a thief go together. So, you know, my thought was, my mantra was that, you know, you can't trust people. You just, you know, you do what you got to do to survive. And that means genuine relationships, honestly, was never my forte. I didn't really have genuine relationships. I had whatever we could do to make each other feel good about our lives. But I never really had genuine ones that was... And maybe they were genuine for other people towards me, but to be honest, I was not authentically genuine towards them. It was always, what can I get or what can you do for me? Relationships.
Well, that makes sense. If you've had those agreements mm-hmm. with yourself of people can't be trusted, mm-hmm. and so vulnerability yeah. would seem like an impossibility at that point. At that point, after you had suffered sexual abuse, mm-hmm. Mr. Sam, mm-hmm. you had started to run away, and no one had ever asked you why you were running away. So what happened as a result of
well,
that?
Well, I was, you know, back then it was in juvenile, they call it status offense. You know, now you can almost kill somebody and not go to jail if you're a juvenile. But in the 1970s, when I was like 12, and if you ran away, you would get arrested and go to juvenile detention center, and you'd have to go in front of a judge. And so eventually, as I was running away, staying with my friends, you know, my mother would call the police, get missing person, and, you know, of course, then they would find me and they would take me juvenile. And then eventually I went in front of a judge, Judge Black. And I think that at that time, I look back now at it and I realized that they were doing a study on Thorazine, and I believe that they needed, you know, just like now we're in the coronavirus thing, and people are, you know, they volunteer to be a research rat, is what I call it. I don't care what nobody say, it's a research rat. You don't know how it's going to react. And so you become a human research candidate. And they will, I believe that the courts have always, the systems of this world has always worked together for what they wanted, the end result. And so I remember going into his courtroom, and I remember him saying that he wanted me to go get a mental health evaluation. And I was like, what does that mean? He said, well, we're going to take you to Longview and to the Child Study Center. And what we're going to do is you're going to be there just 30 days. And we're just going to evaluate what's going on with you and why you keep running away. But the first day I got there, they stripped me of my clothes, put me in this gown, and medicine call came, and my name was on it. And it was liquid Thorazine, 100 milligrams of liquid Thorazine in a little cup with also a little cup of orange juice. And it was like 10 of us in this area, and it was all African-American children. And I now know through that experience, I ended up staying there almost 2.5 years, but I know that through that experience, they also gave us, they did these shock treatments. They would put this thing in our mouths, and then they would put these prongs on our head, like on our foreheads. And then they would just do, I guess it was called electronic something shocking, and it was supposed to change your brainwaves, right? And so they took myself, and it was like four of us. And the reason they kept saying that they were doing that for us was because the Thorazine didn't seem to be working. We still was overactive. And so, but we had no control. So again, there was a point in my life, at that point I was 12. I feel like, so I had 5, and then from 7 to 9, and then from 9 to 12, I was running away. So from 12 to 14 and a half, my mother still didn't come and rescue me. She didn't stand up for me. She said she wanted me that day that I belonged to her, but someone that belongs to you, don't you rescue them? Don't you nurture them? Don't you show them? Don't you come and protect them? So somewhere again, that little girl said through all that shock treatment, through the Thorazine, you know, she was so strong, and she kept saying, see, you can't depend on nobody. And I just feel like that she helped me survive, though. She helped me survive those moments when it was unbearable, when I would be in that room and that light would be on me and they would have us in straitjackets so we couldn't move. And I just remember how I used to think in my head, oh my God, they're going to kill us. They're going to kill us. And eventually, you know, after I had about 6 or 7 of those treatments, they stopped giving them to us, but we still had the Thorazine. But I don't know how it happened, but I have a friend now that she's been in our program several times, and we were in that program together. She's wow. never been right. She's never come back from that. She's never come back. Never. You know, whatever. She was fine when we were there. But the next time I ran into her years later, mentally, that Longview experience stayed a stigma of her life, and she's a schizophrenia disorder right now, and lives, I see her on the streets every now and then, and I'll give her money, and I won't mention her name, but it's just amazing how we both had some of the same experiences, and yet some kind of way, I do believe that little girl's mind, that strong mindset, that resilience, was able to survive through those electronic shock, through the Thorazine. And so I got sick when I was about 14, really bad, and they took me to Old General here in Cincinnati. And they thought I was gonna die because I ended up with pneumonia. And they couldn't treat me though, because they needed consent in order to treat me with certain medications. And so the social worker that was there noticed that I was coming from Longview, and they noticed through my blood how much kind of medication I had in my system. And they said, you know, first of all, we're going to probably need to detox her from this medication in order to really get a good reading on what's going on. But we can't even do nothing until we get someone to sign guardianship who has guardianship of her. And that is how I got out of Longview. It's because they then had to contact the judge or the courts. The courts realized that they had forgotten me again, rejected, abandoned, left. And they contacted my mom. And my mom came to the hospital and she signed the paper so I could get the treatment, but I never did go back to Longview. Right after I got well, I stayed in the hospital a couple of weeks, and right after I got well, I went home with her. And at that point, I went to the hospital weighing maybe 80 pounds. And in 2.5 years, I was weighing about 192.
Wow.
So I had gained, you know, 110, 112 pounds off of the medication and the lack of movement and, you know what I mean? So, again, my identity was lost. This little girl, 12, of 80 pounds, soaking wet, leaves out of there and wakes up in a hospital on her way home as, you know, breasts had formed, weight was there. You know, I was a whole different person. And again, who was I? So another identity crisis, another body image, lack of or understanding who I was.
I can almost imagine it was like being in a haze for 3 years.
It
with
was.
That whole experience.
Yeah, but I remember like it was yesterday.
Yeah. The trauma parts of it for sure.
Yeah.
And I know that the sickness was the main way that you're... foster mother was able to find you because
I got lost in the system with her. They wouldn't answer any of her questions. She did pursue. I found out later she did pursue to look for me, but they just wouldn't, you know, because they kept saying that they were going to let me come home for weekends, which they didn't. So she just kind of, you know, and I will say this, out of her lack of education, understanding the systems, she just didn't know what to do. You know, so when she would go up to the courts to try to get information, because she wasn't my biological mom and she really didn't have legal paperwork on me, that was another hindrance. That was another barrier because she didn't adopt me and she didn't really foster me like people are fostered now through foster care.
She tracked really well.
She just took a friend's child
and
raised her as her own. So that made it very difficult. I mean, I know that now, but I didn't know that then because I'm a little girl wondering why no one's coming to rescue her.
Well, going into chapter 3 is a nice segue because that was the chapter where you talk about you were released out of the mental hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And you had changed, not just physically, but even just mentally, and how you had the pronouncements of your life. No one's going to be able to hurt me. I can't trust anyone. And I'm against everyone and everyone's against mm-hmm. me. And that's how you operated. And you talked about rebelling against authority and being preoccupied with money. And
yeah, well, without
money.
Lack of, you know, we grew up in poverty. So my mother was a single mother who worked, you know, and bought the minimum. She believed in tithing to church. She believed in, you know, goodwill and, you know, secondhand. And so, yeah, I did. I got out of there. And I think, I'm 14, almost 15 years old. I see my friends going to school. My body image has changed. You know, I'm bigger than I used to be. So I'm overcompensating, right? I don't trust authority. So by this time, you know, I'm in a place where who gives a good care? Who cares? And so what else can hurt me at this point? You know, at this point, my mother gave me away. I've been sexually abused. I've been in a mental hospital. I went through shock treatment. It didn't kill me. So, I'm invincible. So I had an invincibility image of myself that I could do anything I want whenever I wanted to. And I didn't care nobody. I didn't care about nobody. I didn't care what people said. I didn't care what you thought of me. And so I began to steal a lot. You know what I mean? And obsession with money. I wanted to have more than I had. I wanted an image. I wanted people to believe I was tough and bad. And, you know, and perhaps I was already without having to put that image on. But I definitely needed to let people know I wasn't to be played with, and nobody was going to take advantage of me no more. Nobody was going to override me. I was going to defend myself, and if I had to cut you through a sword with my tongue, whatever I had to do, my head, my body language, just everything was going to be what it was going to be, and I was going to win, and you was going to lose. And so throughout that process, it just kind of, whether it was relationships or, you know, it was what can I get again? What's gonna benefit me? And I just kind of rebelled against my mom at that point. I really didn't, you know, she had no say. You hadn't raised me at this point. You know, you whooped me. She used to beat me with extension cords, you know, all that kind of stuff. So my sister even now says that, she vowed that she never whooped her children because she's watched me get so many whippings that she didn't understand, like, why I wasn't, like, why wasn't you cooperating? And I think the more whoopings I got, the more rebellious I became, that nobody was going to break me. You know, that nobody was going to make me bend. That I was going to stand up even when you told me to sit down. And I was going to be talking when you told me to shut up. And whether you heard me or not, or whether you saw me or not, I was going to. And that was just my stance on life.
How much did anger play a part in that?
You know what? I'm learning that anger is a secondary emotion. I think pain played the biggest part. Yeah. And so it may have came out in anger. And I don't know if I was angry as much as I was just, maybe I was and didn't identify it as anger. But I was more, if I had to really say an emotion that I was feeling, I would say defiant. You know what I mean? Like, and if that's an emotion, it's like, that's a behavior. It's like, I don't even think I knew how to be feel anger. I just think I felt defensive. And maybe that is a part of anger. So maybe it played a big part. But I just knew that in my heart, you know what? The hell with you. The hell with everybody. And the hell with myself. If you get back, if you really look at it, because at that point, I didn't even care. I can't care about you because I don't care about me, because nobody taught me how to care about me, and nobody showed me what caring about me looked like.
Yeah.
And so from there, you know, I went from coming home from not there to, like, next thing I know, I'm in and out of girls' schools. You know, I'm in Seattle Village, BYC, Buckeye Youth Center. I'm in, you know, because I'm still in Running Away, doing all kind of crazy. I'm in Riverview School for Girls. And by this time, I'm 16 years old, and I done been to 3 institutions. You know what I mean? So my incarceration starts, and I don't really care because I'm going to still get out and do what I want to do. And so this one incarceration, I'll never forget, when I was abandoned from Ohio, they told me that I was a menace to society and that they were not going to spend any more money on me, and that they need that before I could get out of Riverview School for Girls, that my mother or my family needed to move out of the state of Ohio. They wanted to abandon, like, I need you out of Ohio. We're not spending any more money on you. I don't care where you're going. You stay here till you're 18, but if you're family move somewhere else and show us that you have somewhere to live, we will release you out of Riverview School for Girls, but you cannot stay in Ohio.
And that's when I moved was to Kentucky?
And that's how I moved to Lexington, Kentucky. It's almost 17 years old. And then, of course, a whole nother life started.
Is that when you started the thief ring?
Yeah, well, not really. I started the thief ring back in when I was in my 20s, but at 17 is when, you know, I think I share about being in love and having, a few miscarriages and, you know, having the first, you know, where I thought again was love. And it was my first boyfriend, and I ended up getting pregnant and found him in a bed with another girl. And so all of that just, like, was more compound stuff to make this little 5-year-old girl still believe at 17, right? Can't trust nobody, cannot bear your heart to nobody, cannot be vulnerable, cannot. And not that any of those things were my fault, but they were my reality. And so when I ended up getting pregnant, I was 7 and a half months pregnant, 17 and a half. And I was in the bathtub, and my baby just fell in the tub. And I remember, you know, going to the hospital, and they called it an incompetent pregnancy. And so they asked me several times, like, had something ever happened to me? Because it feels like that for that kind of thing to happen, trauma had to have happened at an early age. And I was in denial. I was like, I don't know what you're talking about. And he's like, well, did you have an accident? Did something happen? Because it just seems like there's a lot of trauma to your cervix and to your uterus. And I was like, no, I don't know what you're talking about. So I just wasn't ready to admit that I had been sexually abused. Because again, what happens in this house stays in this house. You are not to tell what happens. You're not to talk about it. As an African-American family, that was really a big mantra of ours. What happens in this house stays in this house. These are our secrets. You don't tell nobody. So it was ingrained in me. And so it was like, no. And so as I moved on, of course, by the time that I was 18, I got caught stealing. And I didn't want to be 18 because 18 means you're grown up. So I, so funny, again, always coming up with creativity. I was 18. I got arrested. I told them that I was 17. And they said, no, you're 18. I said, no, I was born in 1961. And they were like, no, you were born in 19. I said, no, I can show you on my birth certificate. And he's like, okay, bring your birth certificate up here. And when you bring it, we will charge you as a juvenile. But until then, you're an adult. So I went home, came up with this clever idea. And I got my birth certificate from my mom, and she gave it to me, and I changed it. I alternated it. And what I did is, you know, I did everything. I don't even know how I came up with that. Where did that even come from? It was just in me. And so I took a typewriter, and I put the birth certificate in there, and I changed the date because it was a 6, and I put white out on it, and then I put 1, and I kept hitting it on the typewriter. You can just keep hitting it until it comes through the whiteout. And so then what I did is I thought I did everything right, and then I made a copy of the birth certificate, so because they just wanted a copy. And what I forgot to do, I wasn't so smart, I forgot, and this lady said, now, how is your birth certificate born in September 12, 1961, but it was given to you September 22nd, 1960? Tell me how that happened.
Whoops.
And I was like, I'm not sure what happened. This probably was a typical error. I'm not sure what happened. She's like, no, I think what happened is this is a forged instrument. You're presenting a forged instrument. This has been tampered with. Mm. And I was like, what? And I'm sitting there acting like I don't know what she's talking about. She's like, well, I think that we need to see the original. And of course, I had given the original back to my mom. She brought it up there, and you could tell that I had tampered with it. So a theft charge became a theft charge, and then a criminal forged instrument charge. So I just compounded the issue. And for the first time, I was 18, and I was facing prison. And the judge gave me 3 years in prison. At 18, I was on my way to prison by the time I was 19. And from there on, I was in and out of prison, you know, in and out, back and forth, started the theft ring, got, you know, very influential with my girlfriends. And, you know, we were, right, even to this day, you know, we talk and we just look back at those days. But I was the only one who ever went to prison. I always took responsibility for the choices I made to influence them. So, you know, but we made good money. We wore nice clothes. They knew that we call it the boosters. So we was a booster, as what they call a professional boosters. That was our job. We would go to the mall and, you know, take orders for people. And we was like 5 of us, and we consider ourselves professional thieves. And that's what we did for a living.
Was that the group that you also said, now I'm a thief and I'm teaching you to be a thief, mm-hmm. So don't trust me?
Exactly. Ain't no honor among thieves. If I'm teaching you to steal, that means that, you know, like, why would you trust me?
It's not personal.
Yeah, it's not personal. This is a business. And that was kind of my philosophy, my belief systems. And so when stuff would happen and they would be like, I think I should get more money than that. Why? I did the risk taking. Why would you get more money? You know, so it was always about, so that lets me know that I was always a leader, had influence, you know, and you know, over the, when we did my play, a lot of them came up to see the play, you know what I'm saying? We're still friends today. We're all, trust me, right now, none of us are thieves. We're all transformed by the renewing of our mind. We all go to church. We all love the Lord. We all been changed. It's been amazed, you know what I mean? But, you know, we all are different in our lives now. You know, one is a pastor, got her own church, you know. So it's just like so many things that's happened in our lives over the years that created us to be where we are today. But I think it was always, that was always a part of God's plan.
Yeah. Yeah. And the fact that he brought you guys all together and that you all went through transformation.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And now you're at the end of this and you can look back on those things of, here was before Christ, and here is Christ now.
Exactly.
Living in me.
Yeah.
Transforming me. Yeah.
And helping me helping my life, helping other people be transformed.
Yeah.
Exactly.
That's really cool. I didn't know that detail that whole group had come to know Christ, and how you guys can look at all of that from those new lenses, if you will.
Yeah, I did a sister tribe dinner year for last, and they all came. And then when I had my play Chameleon down at the Aronoff, they all came. So yeah,
that's awesome. Well, that'll be a good place to wrap this up. Is there anything that we didn't cover that would be good that you'd want to leave the listeners with related to those three chapters that were the big changes, big traumas?
I think I think the one, you know, like you said, you know, drop versus being dropped off, mental institution, loss of identity. I think they all were connected. And I would say to the audience that little girl had, you know, as you will hear, the other chapters of my book had to be tapped into so she could not run my life. And I am still learning after, you know, I've been in this process now in almost three decades since I left my last prison sentence. But growing her up, not chronologically, but emotionally, developmentally, spiritually, and not killing her, but embracing her and thanking her for helping us get to this moment and realizing that you're going to always be a part of me, and I appreciate you, and I appreciate what you've done for me, but you cannot take us to the next level. Somebody else has got to be in the driver's seat, and it can't be pain, and it can't be childishness. It's got to be a grown-up. So you can either go on the ride with me, or you can be left where you are. I hope you'll go on the ride with me. So always try to embrace that child, because that child needs to be nurtured and loved, and that is how I believe we get over trauma, as we go back to those places and let that child be loved in the proper way. And accepted and seen with right identity.
Yeah. Help them mature the right way.
Exactly.
The safe way. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Well, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All right. Till next time.
You've been listening to the Embracing Change podcast. Music production and mastering by Gone Coastal Productions. Podcast editing and production by Jennifer Osborne. Podcast copyright 2020 by Lakrita Bowman.